Okay, let's open our Bibles to Isaiah chapter 33 this morning. Stability! Stability! Have you ever tried to define stability? Maybe some of you are trying to just stand up and be stable. But when we think of the word stability and trying to define stability, there's a lot of times when I put words in the sermon title, but then I want to make sure you know what they mean. But stability, we all want things to be stable. And I don't mean horses and stables. What is stable? By the way, when I looked up the word stability, it was the position of being stable. That was the first definition. I'm like, oh boy, that's not going to help us. So what's stable mean, right? Besides a horse, a place for a horse, it means firmly established, something that isn't changing or fluctuating, steady in purpose, firm in resolution. Now that's a lot of words and a lot of things to think about. But I want you to consider the words firmly established. You all understand stability and being stable on your feet or not stable on your feet. But you know, we in America want things just to be stable, right? Economically, we don't want high inflation. We want just everything to be good, right? Political stability, you hear those words? I don't know if that'll ever be achieved. I don't know if any of this will be achieved, but social stability, I'm just continuing to read out of the dictionary here. The quality or state or degree of being stable, such as the strength to stand or endure, the property of a body that causes it when disturbed from a condition of equilibrium or steady motion to develop forces or moments that go back to the original condition. I think you get the point. You get the understanding of what stability, firmness, being able to stand up. Isaiah chapter 32, before we get into chapter 33 today, spoke of the Messiah and his kingdom. Divinely appointed and revealed standards are going to prevail in the coming kingdom. And in the government of the Lord Jesus Christ, divinely appointed and revealed standards. Isaiah is a prophet of contrasts. One section of one chapter, he's talking about the coming kingdom. The next section, he's talking about the judgment, back and forth. And he continues that for about two more chapters. Today, we want to look at the subject matter of sovereign and stable. Sovereign and stable, the title of the message, because today we're going to find again that contrast. And Isaiah is going to pronounce his final woe. Some of us might be happy that he's about done with all these individual woes. But part of the book of Isaiah is judgment. The other part is promise. Judgment and promise. Those twin truths are definitely pronounced throughout the book. But here is this final woe, and it comes against the enemies of God's people, specifically directed most likely against Sennacherib and the Assyrians. If you would like to spend time reading about Sennacherib and the Assyrians, you can find it in 2 Kings 18 and 19. But if you don't have time for that, just wait a couple of weeks because we're going to preach out of it in Isaiah 36 and 37. So it's coming up soon, and we'll give you more details about them. But Isaiah chapter 33, and real quick this morning, I just want to mention the woe upon Assyria, and then we'll get into the main part of the message. But when he begins this chapter, you'll notice in verse 1, here's the word that he's repeated a lot, a woe. Woe to, and then he's usually listed Edom, or Israel, or Syria, or Egypt. And now, he doesn't list the specific name of this country, but it's pretty obvious who it is. Woe to thee, or woe to the nation, woe to the country that spoilest. Okay, when we think of spoils, when we think of something that's spoiled, we think of the sour cream container or the milk that's in the refrigerator. That isn't the old-fashioned idea of what spoiled meant like it does here. The idea of something that was spoiled or something that spoiled us was an army that would march into an invading land and take all the spoils, take all the good stuff, you know, the gold and the silver and whatever else was valuable. Those in the old days were called the spoils. So what country in Isaiah's day was doing that? What country was the big bad boy on the block of empires? And as I've repeated over and over, it's the Assyrians. They were threatening the nation of Judah. They were going to overrun Israel. They had overrun other countries. Definitely the nation that was spoiling, that was going around and taking everybody else's land, everybody else's money, and everybody's peoples was Assyria. So we know that Isaiah is pronouncing a woe upon the one who is spoiling, a word that means destroying or ruining. And Assyria was doing just that. It was led by this man named Sennacherib. And we get him from Kings and also Isaiah coming up. The prophet continues, woe to those or that nation that is going around and spoiling. And then watch what he says. And thou was not spoiled and dealt treacherously, and they dealt not treacherously with thee. When thou shalt cease to spoil, thou shalt be spoiled. And when thou shalt make an end to deal treacherously, they shall deal treacherously with thee. I'm going to explain this. It's really not that difficult to understand. The prophet says to Assyria, he says, Assyria, at this point, Assyria has been doing all the destroying and the destruction and the ruining. And up to this point, he says to Assyria, you have not been spoiled or destroyed yourself. That was true. In Isaiah's day, Assyria hadn't been defeated. They were walking around defeating everybody, but they themselves had not been overrun by anybody. Isaiah said, that's about to change. He goes on. He says, you have sent ambassadors, and we're going to see this in chapter 36 and 37, okay? So I got that we haven't talked about it, but I'll just tell you that the Assyrians had sent an envoy. Do you know what an envoy is? A group of ambassadors, a group of representatives from their nation to Jerusalem to demand that Jerusalem give up and just bend over backwards and say, we want your land, just give it to us. And if you don't, we've got a bargain, and we'll talk about all that, what was going on. But they had sent this envoy, these ambassadors, to demand surrender. Okay? In other words, Isaiah is saying to the Assyrians, woe to who is destroying. You have not been destroyed yet, but you have dealt treacherously. The word treacherously, again, a word we don't use very often, means unfaithfully. It means you've been a traitor. You've violated a standard. In other words, the Assyrian king had sent these envoy or these military advisors to demand an unfair surrender. Continues. But they did not deal treacherously with you. These Assyrian officials had dealt with Hezekiah, and we're going to talk about him a whole bunch coming up in 36 through 39. He was the king of Judah at the time, and they had dealt in bad faith, bad bargaining practices, kind of like some of the things we see today, right, around the world. But in return, they had been not dealt that way by the Jews. In other words, the Jews had tried to deal fairly with them, but the Assyrians weren't doing it. It was basically one doing it the wrong way and another group doing it the right way. That's what he's saying here. But notice, when you stop your destruction, when thou ceases to spoil, when the Assyrians, he's pronouncing a woe on them, when you stop doing your spoiling, what's going to happen? It's clear. Notice the next four words. You yourselves will be what? Destroyed. There it is. Isaiah is saying there's coming a time where the Assyrians are going to do a bunch of destroying themselves, but they themselves will be destroyed. They had dealt with people and different nations in this way, in every way possible. Sennacherib and the Assyrians were thieves, they were traitors, and they were tyrants. And the end result would be, Isaiah says, when God, and God, by the way, used the Assyrians to do some damage to his own people in out of judgment. But he said, there's going to be a time where I am going to stop that. That's God through Isaiah saying that to Assyrians. I use you for a time. I'm going to judge my people. By the way, do you know what country the Assyrians ran over before they were stopped and destroyed themselves? The northern kingdom of Israel. And as we'll soon find out, they overran about 37 cities of Judah. But there's one city they could not take, and that was Jerusalem. Once their judgment on Israel had been finished, once they had done their work of judgment on the outskirts of Jerusalem, God would say, that's enough. And God himself would destroy and judge the Assyrians in an amazing show of force where not one person of Judah had to lift a sword. The enemy can think they are in control, but in reality, they are but an instrument in the hands of God. And that is the case of the Assyrian military and the Assyrian Empire. This does not alleviate them of their own choice and sinful actions, because the Assyrians chose as human flesh to do all these things. But God's sovereignty oversaw his choosing to take those who willfully rebelled against him, and that was the Assyrians. They followed false gods. They did not follow Jehovah. But God chose to use these people to work out of some of his judgment upon his own people. And even though they lived opposite of God's ways, he allowed the Assyrians to be used for their judgment, first judgment. But it didn't end well even for them. And that's the woe. That's the pronouncement on these people. But that's not where this stopped. This takes an interesting twist today. You would think the rest of the chapter, right, would be about all the bad things Assyria's done and all the things of why they're... But watch. Notice what Isaiah does. Look at verse 2. Could you tell me what Isaiah does by just looking at verse 2? He says this, O Lord, be gracious unto us. We have waited for thee. Be thou their arm every morning, our salvation also in the time of trouble. You know what Isaiah does? He prays. And for the next few verses, Isaiah offers up a prayer. And that's point number two today, simply the prophet's prayer. And in the prophet's prayer, we find Isaiah either himself or on behalf of the righteous remnant offering a prayer to God, demonstrating their trust in Jehovah and waiting upon the Lord to fulfill this woe. Again, put yourself in Isaiah's sandals or shoes. Put yourself, let's say, during Isaiah's day, you were all faithfully trying to follow God. Meanwhile, the government was corrupt. I know, kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? You're trying to serve God. I don't think too many of us here are looking for big accolades, you know, to be seen in front of everybody. We're just trying to serve the Lord. We're trying to witness. We're trying to see God's work among us. We're trying to faithfully serve him. We don't always have all the answers. We don't understand every last thing in God's word. We need God every day. We would say that. We're waiting, but meanwhile, the nation is getting worse. They're not serving God where they used to be. And it doesn't look good. And now Isaiah pronounces this woe on the main enemy of his people. But they got to wait, because God's judgment upon Assyria doesn't come overnight. And isn't waiting one of the hardest things to do when it comes to trusting God? In fact, it's probably the main thing when it comes to trusting God that's hard to do. Waiting. So Isaiah turns to praying, and he says to the Lord, we appeal to you for your mercy. Be gracious unto us. It was a cry to God on behalf of himself and those who believed to show favor upon his people. And what is the favor that the people and Isaiah are pleading to God for? Here it is. We have waited for thee. Show yourself to be mighty. I'm just putting it into the normal English language. We are waiting. We haven't seen you defeat Assyria. It seems to be getting worse. The walled cities, we've heard the messengers come and tell us that that city just fell to the Assyrians. And that city over there just fell. And the 36th city and the 37th city. And they are coming very close to where we're living. And we are waiting, God. Show yourself to be merciful. You have told us they're going to be defeated. Then the pleading continues. Be thou their arm every morning. Our salvation in the time of trouble. While the people had longingly waited for the Lord's salvation, the protection from this barbarous empire, the Assyrian nation, Isaiah is reminding himself and the people that the righteous are always rewarded for their patience in waiting for Jehovah. Let me repeat that. The righteous are always rewarded for their patience in waiting upon Jehovah. The arm of the Lord references his strength. That, in other words, be our strength every morning. I'll tell you what, when you wait on God, you can be, it's draining. Or it can be. Not because you're doing something wrong per se, not because you may be worrying. And Isaiah is saying, we're weak. So we need you, God, to be our strength. When we are weak, you are strong. And that was his prayer. We can't do anything about this, Isaiah is saying. We know the promise, and we're going to hold on to that promise. And so the arm here, it references the Lord's strength, and it is a pleading. And Isaiah is readily admitting that if the city of Jerusalem is going to be saved, it would be a direct act of the grace of God upon his people. Now, granted, understand, we already know the end of the story, but they didn't. We have the next few chapters on Isaiah. We know what happens to the Assyrians in 2 Kings 18 and 19, and the book of Chronicles mentions this as well. We know what's going to happen to them, but at this point, they know the promise, but they haven't seen the end fruit. They haven't seen the end result. But they realize, and in this prayer of Isaiah, they recognize this would have to be a direct act of grace of God upon his people. In other words, Isaiah is saying both the destiny of the Assyrians and the fate of the Jews were in the hands of Jehovah. But you know who wasn't saying that? A lot of the people in Judah at the time. In fact, remember Hezekiah's own ambassadors. Do you remember where they went? We saw it a few weeks ago. They went to Egypt. They said, "We need to trust in your horses and your chariots." The battle, Isaiah was saying, was going to be the Lord's. And the people needed to trust Jehovah that if he's promised the victory, he would win it in the time of trouble. Edward Young says this, "Every day men need God's strength. When the day breaks in the morning, his strength must be manifested. Therefore, you and I cannot make it through a single day, a single hour, or a single minute without the manifold grace of God in our lives." Every day we need this grace as we wait on the Lord. Did you know you and I are waiting? You may not realize it, but you're waiting for a similar thing to happen. You're waiting for the defeat of the enemy and for the righteous reign and rule of the Lord Jesus Christ. At least I hope you are. As this world shifts and the governments get more corrupt by the day. There's been promises left by God in the Bible that he will win in the end. You know what? We have to wait. We have to wait today. We have to trust in the grace of God for this hour. And it isn't getting any better, friends. For the remnant, then, those who were left behind, there were questions. It's a similar question that you might have. How long are we going to have to wait? How long is the world going to get worse? How long is Assyria going to be allowed to continually run down the next city and the next city? How long? Certainly that's a question these people had in their mind. And Isaiah says, God, be gracious unto us. We will wait for you. Friends, we have to say the same thing. Lord, be gracious unto us. We wait for you. Patiently then, Isaiah waited for God to show himself, only to experience word on the battlefield that the invasion of the Assyrian army was one step closer to Jerusalem. I'm sure they wondered at times where God was. Sometimes we may wonder, why doesn't God just shut this whole thing down and all the stuff that's going on in this world? He could do it. It is times like this when our belief in the sovereignty of God must hold us fast to the faith that Jehovah will keep his promises. It is in this time, in the worst of trials, in the struggles, and let me tell you, Isaiah was in the thick of the worst of it. People didn't like Isaiah. People scoffed at his words. They mocked him. They mocked his God. They mocked Jehovah. And it was in this worst of trials, God had promised to manifest himself, but there was waiting. There was patience that needed to be endured and endurance through this process. Verse 3, he goes on and he prays, at the noise of the tumult, the people fled. At the lifting up of thyself, the nations were scattered. Isaiah now prays in faith as he hears the Lord's voice in a thunderous tumult. What's a tumult? It's not a word we use very often anymore. It's a picture of a loud outburst by an army. So in other words, at the noise of this outburst of the army, the people are going to flee. What is Isaiah saying? Isaiah is looking at Jehovah and he's saying, we are going to trust you that you will do your work. At the lifting up of thyself, at the lifting up, he's praying to God, at your lifting, at your word, at your bidding, the nations will be stopped in their tracks and scattered. Look at Isaiah 30, just to remind you, verses 30 and 31. Verses we've seen in the recent weeks. Listen to what Isaiah wrote here in chapter 30, verses 30 and 31. The Lord shall cause his glorious voice to be heard and shall show the lightning down of his arm, or the lightning down of his arm, with the indignation of his anger, and with the flame of devouring fire, with scattering and tempests and hailstones. For through the voice of the Lord shall the Assyrians be defeated, beaten down, which smote with a rod. God will do his judgment work. And that's what Isaiah is banking on. He's banking on the promise of God. Had it happened yet? They were waiting. It is no different for us. Today we wait for God to continue to do his work and to do the final work of the future. But until then, we are called to be faithful. Look at verse 4. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. The running to and fro of locusts shall he run upon them. Isaiah pictures the leftover spoils that the enemy had planned to bring home with them. You see, Assyria has left their main part of their empire, Nineveh, the capital city. We're all familiar with Nineveh, right? With Jonah. You know how hard a task that was for Jonah to go to Nineveh? You might start to get to understand why. You can see here. Okay, so Assyria had left their main area, their army. They started attacking these different, and they started growing their empire. And everywhere they went, they got the spoils. But the goal of the spoils was to be brought back to their homeland. Okay? That was the ultimate goal. So now they've been attacking these different nations. They've been overrunning them. They're going to overrun Israel, or they already have by this time. And they're on the precipice of overrunning Judah, specifically the capital city of Jerusalem. So what are they doing along the way? They're gathering up all the gold and the silver that they're collecting. And with the goal of taking all that stuff back to their homeland. And so Isaiah is picturing these leftover spoils that the enemy had gathered. But notice what the promise and the prayer of Isaiah was. And your spoil shall be gathered like the gathering of the caterpillar. What's a caterpillar? Caterpillar was an early stage in this view, and a very destructive stage of the locust. Of a locust. Like a locust, which jumps from plant to plant, devouring it, the people will both destroy and devour whatever the Assyrians had spoiled. Just wait till you hear what happens in the story about how Assyrians were defeated. In other words, the Assyrians had spent many days working for their spoils, but like the wheat that is quickly harvested, their spoils will not be brought back to their homeland. Instead, their spoils would be taken right away from them through the judgment act of God himself. And God will intervene. He will quickly deprive the Assyrian nation of its power. And the picture here is that God will do sudden destruction upon the Assyrians, and so fast will the destruction be that there will be a quick removal of their bounty before anyone else can take it. You'll understand more when we get to that part of the story. Next verse. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with justice, or judgment, but justice and righteousness. The result of all the Assyrians' defeat and all the spoils that would be taken from them would be that the Lord would be exalted. As a result of the swift defeat of the people's enemy, Isaiah is now praising God for something that had not happened yet. Again, this hasn't happened. Isaiah is seeing into the future, and he is recognizing in this prayer and in this praise, it's almost like a psalm of praise, where he sees what's going to happen to the enemy, and he lifts God up on high and says, "You are to be praised for what you're going to do." Look at 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 30. And we'll come back to this a couple of times in the future, but I just want to note one verse out of many we could show you today. And when these ambassadors of Sennacherib, or his representatives, or his envoy, came to talk to the Jews, the Jewish representatives, and to try to make bargains with them and try to get them to really ultimately surrender, okay? And again, that's coming up in a couple of chapters in Isaiah. The Assyrians made some outlandish statements. And I want to show you one here. Look in verse 30 of 2 Kings 18. And this is the Assyrian representative Rabshakeh, or however you say his name, but something like that, Rabshakeh. I don't know. I've typed his name a whole bunch of times into my sermons coming up. So he's well known in the Isaiah. It says in verse 28, Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice. Okay, this is the Assyrian. And he cried in the Jews' language and spake, saying, "Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah," that's the king of Judah, "let not the king of Judah deceive you." So he's speaking to the people of Judah, and he's saying, don't let your king deceive you. Well, what about? Don't you want to know what he's going to say next? Well, don't let your king deceive you, for he, number one, will not be able to deliver you from us. So you know what they said? The Assyrians say to the Jews, my king is the great king, and your king will not defeat my king, who is the great king. But notice what else he says, and it's really verse 30 that I want you to see today. He says, neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord. saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and the city will not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. So here's what Rabshakeh and his buddies were saying to the Jewish representatives of Hezekiah. They're saying, first of all, don't let Hezekiah deceive you that he's going to defeat us, number one. And number two, don't trust in the Lord. Because Hezekiah is going to tell you that the Lord is going to deliver you. But let me tell you, our gods, this is what they're saying, our gods will defeat your God, or gods, as we'll find out in a future time. So Sennacherib's representative scoffed at the notion that God could help Hezekiah in the battle with Assyria. Now, granted, they just saw Jehovah just like all the other gods that they had overrun with the other nations. They said, you know what? No other gods of any other nations have been able to stop the great king. So let me just tell you, Hezekiah, that you might think your God is better than those gods, but let me just tell you, Rabshakeh says, your God, no problem for us. Come back to Isaiah chapter 33, verse 5. And what does Isaiah say? Compare that with what Rabshakeh just said, and what Isaiah says. He says, the Lord, or Jehovah, is exalted. He is the one that dwelleth on high. In other words, Isaiah is saying, I trust Jehovah. I believe in his word. I believe his promises. Rabshakeh says to Hezekiah and his group, I don't believe those promises. Don't be deceived that your God will defeat him. You see the difference? But to compare what was going on, a pagan god to the God of Israel was blasphemy against Jehovah, the living God. Let me read another passage to you. Isaiah chapter 10. Listen to these words. Isaiah 10, 10 and 11. As my hands have found the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? That was Sennacherib saying that. Just like I've overrun Samaria and her idols, I'm going to overrun Judah and Jehovah. And all Assyrian king thought Jehovah was just another idol. He was about to find out that wasn't the case. And you know who believed that also? Isaiah. Do you? Assyria thought all gods were idols and graven images. And there are people that go to church that kind of place God on about the same plane. Maybe just a little bit more strong than the idols. But Isaiah said, Jehovah, you are exalted. I believe you. We will wait for you. Why? Because he trusted in the promises of God. You want to know how to know if you are putting Jehovah in the right place? Trust him while you wait. Trust him while you wait. Because that's what Isaiah was doing. The test was, would Isaiah and the remnant trust God? And Isaiah says, I exalt you, Lord. I think that was proof that Isaiah was doing what he was praying. But there's more here today. Jehovah is already lifted up and exalted. Right. You would all agree with me, right? Let me ask you a question. Let's just say that the Assyrians, and I'm just putting this hypothetical because this isn't what happened, but Babylon would do this. But let's say that God allowed the Assyrians to overrun Jerusalem, and eventually he would allow Babylon to do it. Mm-hmm. Was God not exalted then? In other words, isn't God already exalted no matter what outcome might come according to his word? Maybe his word was the Assyrians should run over. So it wasn't that Isaiah, here's my point, it wasn't that Isaiah was saying all of a sudden now the Lord wasn't exalted and now he is. I'm saying the Lord is always exalted. But in the doing of what he was going to show to the Assyrians was another illustration that the Lord is who he says he is. He is glorious. Is he glorious anyway? Yes. But here Isaiah says, we are going to see God exalted high and lifted up, and he hath filled Zion with justice and righteousness. Isaiah states then that Assyria will finally realize the position of the exalted God. In other words, Assyria will know that Jehovah is exalted, and so will Judah. Assyria had conquered many gods up to this point. They had cast those gods down as they wished. To her, Yahweh or Jehovah appeared to be just like another god. But we know Jehovah is different. And in overthrowing the Assyrians, he will show that he is exalted. He dwells on high where no mere man can ascend to bring him down, Edward Young says. But look at verse 6. This is our main verse of the text today. He goes on and he says in his prayer, wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy time, or thy times, and strength of salvation, the fear of the Lord is his treasure. The prophet continues with the theme of the prior verse. Now let me ask you, we should ask Ryan, because he's doing diagramming subjects and verbs in school right now. We should ask Ryan who the subject of verse 5 is. You all should know the answer. Who's the main subject? Who's being talked about in verse 5?
The Lord.
The Lord. He's also the main subject of the next verse. In other words, the subject continues. And really, I think some of the newer translations have brought this out even better. The real literal rendering of verse 6 is this. Listen to me very carefully. And he, God, will be the stability of your times. A wealth of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. The fear of the Lord is his treasure. In other words, what Isaiah is saying is it is God who will be the stability of your times. If you want to learn something today, or if you want to hold on to some hope today, let me tell you, Jehovah is the stability of our times. The word stability means faithfulness and firmness. At the heart of the meaning of the root word for this word stability is the idea, listen to me, of certainty. And this is borne out in Hebrews 11 verse 1. You know what Hebrews 11 verse 1 is? Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. In other words, the part of faith that is kind of the root idea, or one of the root ideas of faith, is the root idea of this word stability. It is the certainty that God will act. It is the certainty that God will keep his word. It is the certainty that God will keep his promises. And Isaiah and the remnant must have wondered, when is this going to happen? It doesn't look good. The times are bleak. But Isaiah prays and he says to God, Lord, you're not only exalted, you are our stability during these times. Oh, to hold on to this today, friends. To hold on to Jehovah being our certainty, our firmness, our faithfulness in this time. The idea then is this. It's in your notes, and I want to make sure if there's anything you see today, it's this paragraph. The idea then is that Jehovah will be the constancy and the trustworthiness of the day. While everything around us, and certainly around Isaiah and his people, was unsettled, the Lord God will always remain their stability and our stability and security. He is truly the one constancy of our day. End of Isaiah's day. What's constant in this day? I'm not. I'm changed from, I mean, this thing, I hope that I mean, I tried to make some attempts of it, but we fail, don't we? Well, friends, I have news for you. Your government isn't going to be it either. And neither is the one over there in that country or that place or this city. But God is. And that's what Isaiah staked all of his claim in life on. He continues. He says, God is a rich store of wisdom and knowledge and the strength of salvation. This gives us the idea that God is completely abundant and gives his wealth. He's full of treasure. In other words, all the abundance of salvation is found in God. Included in the wealth of salvation is his wisdom and knowledge. Listen, nothing moves God. Nothing causes God to wonder what's going to happen next. Can I handle it? Nothing amazes God. We're amazed at God, but nothing amazes God. Why? Because he is perfectly knowledge and perfect wisdom. He already knows the beginning from the end. So if God knows everything, if God is all wise, if God is sovereign, if God is constant, if God is stable, nothing will surprise God. Nothing will amaze him because he knows it all. That's why you can trust in him. That's why your strength of salvation can be in him. That's why Isaiah believed it. And there appears to be a certain gradation here. In other words, there is, if you look at these words and these terms, salvation here in this verse refers to gifts bestowed from without. Wisdom and knowledge are inward gifts, themselves a part of salvation. And lastly, the fear of the Lord, which is the complete entire devotion of the whole man to the Lord. In other words, this verse covers it all. The physical salvation outside, the wisdom and the knowledge, and the whole fear of the Lord is his treasure. That's our God. That's why he can be trusted. That's why he's constant. And so the true treasure, and notice the fear of the Lord is his treasure. The true treasure then is rooted in a grand view of God and his character. And that treasure, which belongs to God, is brought to his people. They can partake in it. That stands in great contrast to the ever-changing false treasures the nation had been trusting in. And they had pinned its hopes upon. You know what Isaiah says? Don't pin your hopes on in the Egyptian horses and the Egyptian chariots and that Egyptian king. Pin your hopes on the stability of your time, on Jehovah. Pin your hopes that he is the strength of your salvation. Pin your hopes on his wisdom. Pin your hopes on his knowledge. Fear him, and that will be your treasure. There's no treasure like God and all that comes with him and all that he is and all that he demonstrates. And here in the middle of everything that was going on, Isaiah affirmed in his prayer, this is what he believed. I like what the commentary said, the Bible Knowledge commentary said, fearing God does not mean being terrified of him, except, of course, those who are being or will be judged. But it means to recognize and respect him and his authority and righteous demands, which in turn results in godly living, worshiping, trusting, serving, and obeying him. Those who fear him find him to be their sure foundation, their source of inner security and peace. The rock. And you know, Isaiah had a verse about that, didn't he? Go back to chapter 26, you already know the verse. But remember 26, 3 and 4? Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusts in thee. Trust ye in the Lord forever, for in the Lord Jehovah, the Lord Jehovah is everlasting what? Strength. So God's kingdom will be established. That's chapter 32. God is exalted. He's the exalted Lord that's going to fill Zion with righteousness and justice in that time. But when man continues in his ways, the results will be devastating. Look at the miserable plight of those who decide to go the opposite direction. And that's what Isaiah describes here next. Look at the miserable plight of those who follow their own ways. Quickly here, verses 7 through 9. Behold, their valiant ones will cry. The ambassador of peace will weep bitterly. The highway will be laid waste. The wayfaring man will cease. He hath broken the covenant. He hath despised the cities. He regardeth no man. The earth mourneth and languisheth. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Here's the reality. Isaiah says, many living in this day do not believe what I just prayed. I'm just basically telling you that's what he's saying here. Because they thought they could achieve peace and freedom through making alliances with nations like Egypt. That's where they thought their freedom was going to come from. That's where they thought their strength would be achieved from. Notice the first word of verse 7. Did you catch it? Behold! Isaiah uses this word quite frequently, woe and behold. Behold, I got something I want to tell you people who aren't following God. Behold! Isaiah brings us face to face now with the current conditions of the people. Notice who he points out in verse 7. Who's he point out in verse 7? The brave ones. You know, the soldiers of the army. There weren't too many brave ones, but he points them out. Behold, you brave ones. I think we have this idea that somebody who's brave doesn't cry. That's kind of, you know, I'm going to fight for my country and, you know, brave and I'm courageous and I don't show any emotion. Okay? But notice that the brave ones were going to be the ones that were going to cry. Why? Because they realized what was going to happen. They realized they couldn't do anything about it. But not only that, the ambassadors of peace, those were the people that probably Hezekiah sent down to Egypt. Notice what their reaction, Isaiah says, is going to be. They are going to find out that going down to try to find peace with Egypt would only result in weeping bitterly. So the brave soldiers were left crying. You know why they were crying? Because they witnessed that their surrounding cities were falling one by one to the Assyrian onslaught, and they couldn't stop it. The ambassadors of peace weep with great anguish over the fact that their peace efforts ended in failure. Egypt would be of no help. Sennacherib would break his word with Hezekiah, as we'll find out. And the realization then that Jerusalem was in grave danger reduced these mighty men and their ambassadors to weeping. But not only that, look at verse 8. Meanwhile, the conditions outside of Jerusalem were in bad shape. The highways were destroyed. I-5 was damaged beyond repair. The Guide Meridian and the Hannigan, you couldn't get from over the river. The highways were destroyed. The roads had been laid siege to. Travel was dangerous. Covenants were broken. Cities were despised. Man's life was treated with total disrespect. That's verse 8. And verse 9, the whole land was in mourning because of the picture of the devastation of the Assyrian army upon Palestine. Isaiah describes Lebanon, the mountains to the north, Sharon, the rich land to the south, Bashan, the land northeast of the Sea of Galilee, noted for its oak groves and rich grazing land, and Carmel, the mountainous region that juts into the Mediterranean Sea, as all of them being cut down, ashamed, a wilderness, and stripped of their fruits. The picture of the land then is total destruction. Assyria's conquest had dominated the land, causing it to become still, cold, and lifeless. Such was the life of those in Judah who trusted in Egypt instead of Jehovah. But lastly today, Jehovah shows his sovereign control over his people. Remember the title of the sermon today? Sovereign and stable? We've seen who the stability is. Now let's see God as sovereign. Look at verse 10. Now I will rise, saith the Lord. Now I will be exalted. Now I will lift up myself. You will conceive chaff. You will bring forth stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you, and the people shall be as the burnings of lime, as thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire. The Lord now responds and declares, he will be exalted. Man will do nothing to gain the victory. The Lord will be the one that gains the victory. God has now chosen the time for action. Notice there is a word that is emphasized, and it's the first words in verse 10. First word. Notice it. Now. In other words, there's coming a time, and it is now, that I will rise up. I will be exalted. I will show myself. I am the Lord. And it shows, this word now shows that while man's empires have exalted themselves and they have attempted to conquer the world, now is the time that God will act and demonstrate who really is the exalted one. Assyria said, Rabshakeh said, I represent the great king. Jehovah says, I will be exalted. God is waiting. We know that from Isaiah 33, verse 2. Isaiah is waiting for God. God is waiting, but he will arise. He is biding his time and withholding his judgment, but the time will come where he will intentionally engage in action against his enemies. It's going to come. All men will then know that the Lord, he is God. No man will be able to stop him. Those who oppose him will be defeated, and he will wield his power in all his deeds. And the result in verse 11, here's what happens to the Assyrians when God gets involved. Notice the word conceive. The word conceive means to become pregnant. You shall be, in other words, Isaiah says, the Assyrians will become pregnant on chaff. Now, friends, I like a sandwich, but it's usually not made out of chaff. And I, you know, chaff is the stuff that you kind of want to get rid of. At least I've always thought that, right? You want the wheat. You want the wheat bread, right? You don't become pregnant on chaff. But the picture is of this. The enemy had become pregnant on chaff because the chaff represented that it had trusted in its own means and methods to become enlarged. But it all that is brought forth is the leftover stalks of grain from the harvest. You will bring forth what? They got pregnant, they got enlarged on the chaff, on trusting their own ways and their own deeds, and all that they brought forth was stubble. The leftovers. The not so very, you know, just the nothingness. In other words, here's what Isaiah is saying. The Assyrians thought they were going to conquer Jerusalem. Their schemes, and they were getting enlarged on all the enemies they were defeating. But there was an enemy that they did not comprehend and did not recognize the strength and power. The same person who is our constant in our life. And it was Jehovah. And all their schemes would only give birth to the empty stalks of chaff and straw. All of the Assyrian plans would amount to nothing. Their army was planning to attack, and we'll see that coming up. And they were, you notice the picture? Look at the end of verse 11. Here's the picture, and I'll give you a demonstration. We can't wait to get to Jerusalem. They were panting to get the next city. Their breath as fire shall devour you. But their breath, their hot breath, would only become a fire that would destroy them. You see, their desire was to take Jerusalem, and notice what the end result for them would be. And the people shall be as the burnings of lime. They thought they were going to devour Jerusalem. They were waiting and panting. But in the end, if I could say it this way, all that hot breath was turned on them by God. And the end for them is a horrible picture. A burning of lime. Now, again, a phrase we don't use, but let me give you an idea of what this means. The result of the Assyrians is that they would be burned to lime. The word lime is a word that means calcium oxide. Now, I am not a chemist. I don't purport to understand most of what I'm about to say to you. I'm just trusting what the commentators told me. When one heats calciferous material to hot temperatures, the result is lime, a white plaster-type powder. In other words, the picture here is of the people, this army of Assyria, will become like plastic-type powder. The picture is total annihilation by the judgment hand of God. Notice the last phrase. There will be like thorns cut up and burned in the fire. The picture's pretty obvious there. Every year, a couple times a year, Judy and her mom come over to the row of rose bushes out front. Now, we had, up through the first 16 years of our marriage, we had one rose bush planted every year for how many years we had been married. And I counted the other day, we only have 16, and we just had our 22nd anniversary yesterday, so we're six behind. We're taking up donations for the other six. But every year, Judy and her mom go out and they prune the, I don't know, I see them on the ground and I pick them up and I always get stuck with them because the, you know, the thorns stick me. And it goes over to the burn pile. Now, we ourselves don't burn them. Laura, Judy's sister, takes them out to the farm, or Judy's mom takes them, dumps them on the burn pile. That's the picture. The thorns are burned up in the fire. The people will be like that. Friends, what can we learn today? Three things I leave with you. Number one, fighting against God is a worthless venture. Fighting against God is a worthless venture. Over and over in the Bible, we see that illustrated. Some of us can speak of that, can we not? When we tried to fight against God and how worthless of a venture that was. Number two, making our plans without God in mind is a worthless activity. James speaks of that in James chapter 4. Making our plans. And that's what the Jews were trying to do. Making their plans without God. And number three, while everything around us is unsettled, the Lord God will always remain our stability and security. I think that's a lesson we can learn today. Let's close.